From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Honest Abe Lincoln was the most rough-hewn of American presidential candidates, no match for the polish and position of his fierce rivals in 1860. But Lincoln won the White House and guided the nation through its deepest trial, the Civil War. And he did it astonishingly with precisely his greatest rivals at his side. He did it, says historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, in a big new book, with storytelling, deep acumen, and extraordinary presidential empathy. This hour on Point, Doris Kearns Goodwin, on the rise and unorthodox rule of Abraham Lincoln and her own trials as a presidential historian. You can join the conversation. Have you followed Doris Kearns Goodwin through her works on Kennedy, LBJ, FDR? How did you weigh the plagiarism charges around this prize-winning historian? Are you ready to dive in with her into the life of the American icon, Abraham Lincoln? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Doris Kearns Goodwin. She's author of the best-selling Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream, the Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys, and her baseball memoir, Wait Till Next Year. In 1995, she won the Pulitzer Prize for No Ordinary Time, Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, the Home Front in World War II. Her new book is Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. Welcome, Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
It's wonderful to have you. You've got such an amazing way of pulling history together. And, of course, as an Illinois kid, this is a story near and dear to my heart. You know, we grew up in that part of the world, seeing Abraham Lincoln at the fore, way ahead of George Washington and all the rest. And there's so much I want to dive into here. It's a big, rich, wonderful telling that you do. But I want to deal with this the period you just come through first, if we may, and go straight at it. I mean, here you are, Pulitzer Prize, a wondrously beguiling, absorbing, persuasive storyteller of history, which makes us want to understand all the more precisely how this happened. The charges of plagiarism, your response, you make big sweeping characterizations that are wonderful to kind of bathe and swim in, but it makes it all the more important for us to understand your integrity and honest and credibility and character. You were kind of the pinnacle of all things popular historian. You were on all the television shows. You were analyzing everything for us, quick draw historian, and it was said in part from jealousy by some historians, but as a compliment as well. What do you make of this kind of walk in the wilderness you've just come through, Doris Kearns Goodwin?
Well, you know, the important thing to understand is what happened nearly 20 years ago. And when it was brought to my attention, I had credited the author. So actually, a series of great historians wrote into the paper to say that does not constitute plagiarism since the author was credited. I just failed to
put...
I failed to put quote marks in the right places. As soon as it was brought to my attention, I corrected it in a subsequent edition. When it came back up again 3 years ago, I acknowledged it once more. And, you know, the weird thing is that people assume that somehow your life was not going on when this was occurring in the journalist world. But two things were happening at the same time that mattered far more to me in a lot of ways. My son had joined the Army and was in Iraq during that period of time. Mm-hmm. My husband had written a play, which he had worked on for 10 years on Galileo, mm-hmm. and it was put on in England to great success. So simultaneously with having to deal with this, the best way to deal with it is to acknowledge that you made a mistake and just to make sure that in this book, everything is doubly checked, triply checked, so I'm sure that everything is fine.
And we know that in those years, you were marinating in the story of Abraham Lincoln, and I really want to turn to it. But we also want to know what you learned from that. I mean, that kind of public criticism is difficult. It has to be wounding, even when other things are going on. Even when a son is in Iraq, it cannot be fun. What about your self-reflection during that time? Did you, you've really danced away or simply walked away from this word plagiarism. Did you have a kind of repentance here? Did you accept that something was fundamentally wrong and resolve in your time in the wilderness to do things differently henceforth? Describe your... I only ask and belabor it because we do rely on your credibility so much with the kind of great sweeping histories that you write. So we want to understand how you dealt with that.
Well, first of all, it's not like I really was in the wilderness during that period of time. I was speaking to public audiences.
Yes, but not on TV in the same way. Every time we turned around before, there you were. Suddenly, there you weren't.
Well, I was still on NBC. My contract has stayed with them. I have now an exclusive contract with them. But anyways, your point is well taken, which is that it's certainly hard when you're a public figure and your reputation has been called into question. And on the other hand, there's a benefit of being a public figure, that people know your work. They come out to see you. They read your books. And you realize it's a price to pay. And there's nothing more you can do than to say that something happened a while ago, you made it right, and you won't have it happen again. That's it. What else can you do?
I don't know. And people come out of that kind of experience sometimes with acknowledging, you know, here's the flaw, and here's how I intend to correct it.
Right. And I did say that. The flaw was in the way I checked the manuscript against the books that I was reading. And I was doing it in handwriting rather than with a computer. And I was doing it over a long period of time. There were thousands of footnotes. The author was credited. And you just make sure that it won't happen. So it won't.
You write great big books, and they sweep us up in their arms and take us away. You do it with the help of researchers. Help us understand that process, because you have pointed to that in part as perhaps where things went wrong here. Do you write your own books? Do you pull together the research of others and bring your narrative thread through it? How does it work exactly?
No, it certainly was not any researcher's fault. It's clearly my fault. And the researchers don't write a single word of the book. What happens is I've actually had only one person who's worked with me on all sorts of projects mm-hmm. for 20 years, mm-hmm. not only on the books, but on television stuff and various lectures, et cetera. And then, for example, with Lincoln, there have been people in Chicago, somebody in Washington, who've done some work in the archives, and then they copy materials, send it to me, but then I'm the one that has to work from those materials.
So how do you see your highest value add in this process? You're discovering the narrative. You're bringing us the new shine or really big new angles on the story. Is that where the Doris Kearns Goodwin touch comes in?
Well, you know, when I first wanted to do something about Abraham Lincoln, it was daunting because there's been so many fantastic books written about him.
As much as about Jesus.
Exactly so. But I knew I wanted to live with him somehow, and I wanted him to be my companion, and I wanted to learn about the Civil War. So it had to be at the start a leap of faith to figure, could I find an angle that might be different from what anybody else had written about, or at least a little bit new? And I didn't know that until a couple of years into the research, when I came upon the fact that he seemed to be spending so much more time with these characters in his cabinet, Stanton and Seward and Chase and Bates, mm. even than Mary, because at first I thought maybe I would do Abe and Mary as I had done Franklin and Eleanor
mm-hmm,
Roosevelt,
mm-hmm.
and I realized that she couldn't carry the public side of the story.
There wasn't quite enough to Mary on the public
side.
Mary
Todd Lincoln. Exactly. There was some stuff on the public side. She went to hospital. She redecorated the White House, but it was no way that she was Eleanor. So once I saw that these people were fabulous in their own right, and of course realized they had been his rivals, and that unusual step he took of bringing them into the cabinet, there was sort of that sense of, yes, I finally have my story. And also, they kept diaries. They wrote letters. So the material was so fantastic to work from.
And what about your approach? You know, there have been lots of niches ticked off in recent years, going at Lincoln's weaknesses. Lincoln was depressed. Lincoln was gay. Lincoln was this. Lincoln was that. Were you setting out to rehabilitate Abraham Lincoln? Michiko Kakutani, New York Times, calls this a return to the hagiographic tradition, the laudatory tradition. Is that just in your bones, or that's what you found, and so you write it?
Oh, no, certainly he didn't need any rehabilitation from me. I think Lincoln's doing fine with historians. Almost all historians, I think, who've worked on him would say that it was one of the great experiences of their life to know and be with this kind of a great leader. And what happened simply was you work on the material, you do find flaws in them, but his overwhelming strengths were so much greater than his flaws that I came away with great respect and affection for him.
We're going to look at the men who surrounded Abraham Lincoln in office as he prosecuted the most difficult war in American history, of course, the Civil War. What was it that you found, Doris Kearns Goodwin, that set him apart, that continues to set him apart as an American leader?
You know, what surprised me, I'd always thought of him as the great emancipator and a great statesman, but his political genius was really what came through as I studied this year after year after year. And I believe that political genius rested on his emotional strengths. I mean, here was a man who didn't hold grudges when someone had hurt him in the past, who acknowledged error as soon as it was happening, who shared credit with everybody else, shouldered the blame for the failures of his subordinates, wrote hot letters instead of being able to yell at somebody so that he could then put them aside, All of these things, I think, allowed him to deal with people. And, you know, you think about politics, it's all about human relationships. And he was a master at human relationships. And that's the underpinning, I think, of his great success.
His empathy you describe as a major tool. But when you say his emotional strength, because that gets our attention, because he's simultaneously known as a president who wrestled with deep melancholy, some have said depression. What's the link?
Well, I think in some ways he was born with a melancholy temperament. I think people are either born with a melancholy or an optimistic temperament, according to some studies. And there were so many losses in his early life. But he knew he had talent. He knew he was smart from the start. And he had huge ambitions, not just for office or power, but to create something that would stand the test of time. And I believe that dream carried him forward. And it allowed him to go through a lot of failures in his life until he reached the point where his talents were truly being exercised. But I think the empathy came from his temperament. He understood other sides of issues, it seemed. He understood people who came from different points of view, whether it was temperance advocates. He gave this great speech when he was a young man to a temperance organization in which everybody else was just screaming about people who drank too much and dram sellers. And he said, you're never going to change their minds by denouncing them. Denunciation leads to denunciation. Instead, you have to reach into their heart and try and change them through reason. And that became his whole approach, I think, to politics. And I think it was a remarkable quality.
I was absolutely drawn by exactly that incident. And yet, we have to hold up against that the fact that he was no sooner president than he was at war with the same people who he was saying he could not denounce. So his kind of tolerant embrace of them did not deter the nation ultimately from civil war.
No, of course not. I mean, in the 1850s, unlike other orators, he did try to understand where the South was. I mean, everybody else was castigating the Southerners as evil, unchristian men, and he said they are what we would be in their situation. If we had slavery, we wouldn't know what to do with it. They didn't. They would not introduce it. But nonetheless, war came.
We're talking with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin about the rise and rule of Abraham Lincoln and about her own path through presidential biographies and a bit of scandal. Her new book is Team of Rivals: The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with best-selling author and Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her new book is Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. You can join us. Are you swept up again in the somber American majesty of the Lincoln story? Do you see the power of empathy in politics, in leadership? And what's the message across the years in the way of Abraham Lincoln? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Doris Kearns Goodwin, I wish you'd give us the thumbnail sketch of this array of men, as it happened, around Abraham Lincoln, and their sort of paths to power, very different from Lincoln's own.
Absolutely. I mean, I think my favorite character was William Seward, who had been the governor and senator from New York. Absolutely thought he would be the nominee.
Very colorful character, dressed in old-fashioned style, even in the mid-19th century.
Very much like Churchill. Mm-hmm. I mean, he drank and he smoked and he lived a full, huge life. He loved to tell stories, play cards, and Lincoln ended up really becoming close to him. But at the time when he lost the nomination, since everyone assumed it was his, it was almost an irrecoverable disappointment. 10,000 people were outside his home in Auburn, New York. Champagne was already waiting to be
uncorked. Cannons pulled into place, ready to fire.
And then somehow when Lincoln made him Secretary of State, he assumed that he would be the one in charge, Lincoln a figurehead. Within months, he understood Lincoln's qualities and surprisingly gave up his own ambitions and became his great friend and ally. Lincoln loved nothing more than spending time with Seward. So that's my first guy.
So he gave up on that, but not until Lincoln had turned away some pretty tough hip checks.
Absolutely. No, at the beginning, Seward, thinking that the administration was drifting before Fort Sumter, writes Lincoln this incredible memo, which says, you know, if you need somebody to run things, I'm here, essentially.
Right.
And Lincoln, rather than firing him, just sort of said, if somebody must do things, it's me who's going to do it. He saw then that this man had iron beneath that soft exterior.
Lincoln no longer a pauper at this point in his life, but nothing like mansion-living a guy, William Seward or Edward Bates, who came out of Missouri.
Correct. In fact, Edward Bates came out of Missouri, had had a plantation when he was growing up, had slaves in his early life because he originally came from Virginia before moving to Missouri. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about Bates is, you know, sometimes I think male historians in the 19th century forgot that private lives affect the public careers of their people. You know, sometimes they wouldn't even mention that a guy had a wife or a child.
Right.
In Bates's case, he had very great ambitions as a young man, had been involved with the statehood of Missouri, went to Congress as a young congressman, but fell in love with a woman, Julia, that he loved so much.
And with their home life.
With their home life, that he didn't want to be away from her. On the way to Congress, he's writing, "What am I doing going so far away from home? I miss you. It's indefinable." And in turns, they ended up having 17 children. So he did spend more time at home, gave up certain cabinet posts, and really only came back into public life in 1860 when the conservatives thought if he were to run for president, maybe he could hold some of the border states or the northern southern states together. And it turned out not to be so. But he, too, when he was made attorney general as Lincoln's rival, thought not so highly of Lincoln at the beginning, somewhat incompetent, nice guy. Mm-hmm. At the end, he said he was a near perfect man. So Lincoln certainly got to Bates.
And another one of these men who had gone west in his own lifetime, from family wealth in Virginia to St. Louis, which was a booming town at that time. I want to look at that, at the challenges that these men felt they faced. But we have to look at Chase, Salmon Chase, and his ambitions. Never quite extinguished.
Exactly.
Or realized.
Until he died, he still wanted to be president. Salmon Chase originally came from New Hampshire, from a quite distinguished family, and had gone to Dartmouth. I mean, all of these other guys were college educated, unlike Lincoln, having to learn on his own. He ended up in Ohio, and what happened to him in some ways was that his family life was so sad, in my judgment. Mm. His three wives died young, one at 22 in childbirth, then another at 25, mm-hmm. one at 32. So the only thing left for him was this relentless ambition to be president. He had a daughter who became his surrogate wife, Kate, considered the most beautiful woman of her age, and he educated her, really, to be his companion. And the two of them together worked so hard for the presidency in 1856, 1860, 1864, 1868, 1872,
right.
never having achieved it. And he was really a foil for Lincoln in a way. Unlike Lincoln or Seward, who loved telling stories, relaxing, warm, open people, Chase was... He didn't want to drink. He didn't want to smoke. Mm-hmm. He would practice jokes that he could never quite deliver with ease. But wonderful for historians, he kept a diary from the time he was 20 years old in which he poured all of these ambitions into it. So he gets into the cabinet as Secretary of the Treasury, does a great job, even though Lincoln and he never really do get along. But Lincoln keeps him on as long as he's doing a good job.
Hard to imagine rivals so fierce being pulled so close. To help us do that, you take us all the way back to the beginning with Lincoln. And I wish you'd put us there. What, as I recall, you've got him in a very young, 5 or 6, sitting in the cabin in Kentucky where his father would be swapping stories, absolutely the coin of his career, with travelers headed east or west, more likely. And what Abe Lincoln, how he responded to that, what he took from that.
Yeah, it's amazing. Lincoln said that as he was listening to his father tell stories with the people coming by the road, he would go upstairs and he couldn't go to sleep until somehow he could recreate those stories in 7-year-old language so that the next day when he was working in the field, he could stand on a tree stump and retell the stories to his friends. So I think he gained even then the pleasure that an attentive audience provides. And then storytelling became his currency in many ways. When he's a young lawyer and they travel on the circuit together, they live together, the judges, the lawyers, the bailiffs, and the sheriffs, for 2 months every spring and every fall in courthouse after courthouse as they move along the way. And everyone would come from miles around to listen to Lincoln tell stories. He would stand with his back against the fire and for 4 hours tell one winding mm-hmm. tale after another.
And
so
you,
that's him.
You describe that as the key not only to winning these rivals, but ultimately to sharing a narrative of the nation, the pain of the nation's understanding of itself, in the words that are so famous, the Gettysburg Address and right on through.
No, I really think that's true. I mean, I think what storytelling is it connects people from one generation to the oral history of the past. I mean, think about people that tell stories in their families. They're telling stories of what happened to people that were your ancestors. And he was able to translate that extraordinary capacity to give America a sense of its past with the Declaration of Independence, with the Constitution, and its future through those great Gettysburg Address and second inaugurals.
There were stories with humor. We heard you over the weekend on NPR telling the story of George Washington in the English outhouse, but there's another one about the woman who had a dress kept over from the Revolutionary War. We should tell us a couple of those. Lincoln's humor.
Sure. Well, the one with George Washington is really my favorite in a sense. He used to tell the story of Ethan Allen, who was a Revolutionary War hero, and he went to Britain after the war, and they wanted to humiliate him still, or tease him anyway. Mm-hmm. So they put a picture of George Washington in the outhouse where they were sure he would be mad to see it. But he comes out smiling, Lincoln said. And they said, well, didn't you see George Washington there? And he said, I did. It's the perfect place for him. What do you mean? They said, well, he said, there's nothing to make an Englishman shit faster than the sight of George Washington.
If Ethan Allen said it, it can't be wrong.
Exactly so.
And the kissing the Revolutionary War dress, I love that one as well.
What this one was to do with there was a man who some years, maybe 30, 40 years after the Revolution, was still collecting every relic that was part of the Revolution. He was obsessed. Mm. So he found a woman who had worn a dress during the Revolutionary War when she was 16 years old. And he goes to her house and he said, could he see the dress? She brings it down from the attic and he kisses the dress. And she's a rather practical old lady. So she said, you know, if you really want to kiss something old, you better kiss my ass because it's 16 years older than that dress. You know, these stories just made people laugh. They made people... Lincoln would light up when he would tell a story. That sad face suddenly took on a whole different demeanor. His eyes would sparkle, and they said he laughed louder than anybody else.
Yeah. And it caught people again and again. But in both those stories, it's interesting. The reference point is the Revolutionary War. And you write, Doris Kearns Goodwin, that this generation of American leaders felt themselves very much in the shadow of the original founding fathers. They were standing just over the time horizon there and wondering, Abe Lincoln, perhaps above all, if they would ever stand up to that stature, make a mark worthy of those forebears.
You're so right. I mean, he gives a famous speech called the Lyceum Speech as a young man, in which he worries that his generation doesn't have the challenge that the founding fathers had. They had this great thing that they succeeded in so well in creating our experimental democracy, and their names were on rivers and streams and mountains, and he worried that his generation just had modest ambitions, maybe a seat in Congress, maybe even a presidency without much ambition. Little could he have imagined that the anti-slavery movement in the 50s would lead to the Civil War, would lead to a challenge even greater in some ways for his generation than faced by the founding fathers.
Mm, it's a terrific telling that you bring us, and you really do bring it to life. I want to begin to bring our callers in. So many of them want to join us. We're talking with Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her new book is Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Gwen is calling from Needham, Massachusetts. Hi, Gwen. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I, like you, Tom, grew up in Bloomington, Illinois.
Oh, no kidding.
And our cars had Land of Lincoln on the license plate.
Absolutely. And, of course, as Doris Kearns Goodwin writes, that's one of the towns that Lincoln would come through when he followed the circuit judges.
Absolutely.
Indeed it was. And I'm interested in remembering how simplistic a story, yet has a wonderful story. You and I, the stories we grew up with, Abraham Lincoln.
Mm.
But now, our hero is shown in such complexity that many people don't know what to do with a hero with such complexity, because there's somewhat of a tension or an ambivalence between sort of the mellow joy of how we were remembering those stories of our youth. And here he is so wonderfully complex, and to have that painted for the people who wish to pursue it further.
To really understand, to see what they can take away from it.
Yes.
It's a great question, Gwen. The sort of, we love the simple children's story version, and yet when we dive in, these are, of course, complex people, and Abraham Lincoln, extremely complex as a historian. How do you deal with that tension, or do you see it in tension, the simple hero's storyline and the historian's view?
You know, it's very interesting. I think any of us that grew up, not even in Illinois, but with these blue biographies of Lincoln, where there's something emotional about this young kid reading by candlelight at night, his mother dying. So it gets into our soul in a way that most other presidents may not. But of course, he becomes a public leader. He has flaws. You read about the kinds of things he said during that debate with Stephen Douglas that don't show a spacious racial equality that you might have hoped he would have had. But that doesn't mean that...
Could you be more pointed on that?
Sure, I'd be glad to do that. In one of the debates with Stephen Douglas, and this has become a big topic of conversation in modern years, and understandably so, he was talking... Stephen Douglas was baiting him to say that by supporting anti-slavery, he really wanted interracial marriage, and he wanted blacks to be equal to whites. Mm-hmm. And if he had ever come out for equality of blacks and whites, he would have lost the race flat down. Illinois had black laws on the books that prevented blacks from voting, prevented them from standing in
juries.
Lots
of tension in his own state.
Exactly so. And so what he said at the time was, you know, that he wasn't sure that America was ready for blacks to be voting or standing on juries, sitting on juries, I guess is a better way of saying that, and that when you have a universal sentiment, it's something that has to be watched in a country that's a democracy. Now, the thing is that I do think that does show, if you define racism as having a prejudice toward the black race or the white race or whomever it is, it probably does show that. But the overwhelming majority, sadly, of the country felt that way. Even abolitionists who were against slavery didn't really feel a sense of belonging to a real black-white equality at that time. And when you think about it, it took so many years later, another century, before we ended segregation, before we gave blacks the right to vote. So it was the country as a whole, I think, that suffered from this kind of prejudice, and Lincoln was party and parcel to that.
And yet you write his family, even to his father, had been opposed to slavery as in opposition to American ideals. The complexity that Gwen's talking about there, and simplicity at the same time, opposition even when he was a kid.
Right. I mean, see, there's a big difference between people who were then opposed to slavery and yet not able to fully see that the slaves, once freed, could become equal to whites. Mm-hmm. And that took a longer period of time for people to understand.
Is your sense that the American big, broad, general sense of Abraham Lincoln, the guy sitting in the wonderful monument in Washington, lines up with what you found in 10 years of research into this man? Is there a general confluence between the public, you know, mythology of Lincoln and what you as a historian have found?
I do think that he's one of those presidents that the public mythology, which is basically respectful, admiring, has absolute roots in history. And, you know, it's one of the interesting things. When I started this project, there are a group of Lincoln scholars who've spent their life on Abraham Lincoln, and they're some of the best historians in the country, and they were remarkably generous to me as a rookie coming into the field.
You see that in your acknowledgments.
Yeah, no, I mean, they really were terrific. But more importantly, they, having spent their lives on Lincoln, would, I think, argue that he is clearly one of our best presidents, and that whatever is found in recent years has not taken away from that, but simply supported the fact that he was a complex, just as Gwen said, a complex human being with some weakness and some strengths, but still quite great.
Connor's calling from Naperville, Illinois. Hi, Connor. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? I'm enjoying the interview a lot. I have a question for Doris. I do a significant amount of professional speaking, and I study the art pretty aggressively. And one of the things about Lincoln that has intrigued me, and I've had some debates with people, is whether or not Lincoln was a great speaker or whether he was just a great speech writer. And the reason why I say that was, if you take things like the Gettysburg Address or the second inaugural, both of them are wonderful pieces of text. But if you consider that Lincoln at that stage, I think, was probably going through a fair level of melancholy and maybe despair. Good speech needs body language and good tone, etc., as well as the words. And I'm just wondering, was he actually seen as being a great speaker as well as being a great speech writer?
Connor, it's a great question, and what a welcome setup for Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Oh, it's a great question, and I don't think I've ever been asked that question before, and I think it's terrific.
Though you write about it in some detail, the way he presented.
The answer comes from the people who listened to him speak at the time. Yes, he did have a thin, high-pitched voice, so that's maybe not what one might expect from him. But they say that when he first stood on the platform, before he was about to speak, he would look so sad, he would look awkward, since his body language was rather awkward. But the moment he began to speak, there was such authenticity, such conviction in his voice, that even in the 1850s, people knew they were in the presence of a great speaker as well as a great writer. I mean, interestingly, at the Gettysburg Address, because it was so short, he wasn't sure that it had made the impact on the audience that he had hoped, because they were just stunned when he finished 2 minutes later.
Silent.
And he worried that maybe it wasn't as good as he had hoped it would be. And that may be one where history records it even greater than it was at the time. But mostly when he was in those debates with Stephen Douglas, he was so funny. He was so quick. He was so able to point counterpoint. When he gave speeches earlier on, people felt at Cooper Union and at Peoria speech that they had heard one of the great speakers of the time. So it was because of his person getting his body language, even if it was awkward. They said his hands went in funny directions.
He tried to hide his arms behind himself.
He didn't know what to do with his long legs. But none of that took away, evidently, from the conviction that he expressed.
Stephen Douglas, much more polished in the traditional sense Connor's talking about here. But Lincoln, you write, you describe people saying he somehow connected so deeply, so intimately with people's sense of right and reason.
And that's really true. What happened in those days, so unlike our own, is that people could talk for 2 hours and use argument, use history, mm-hmm. really trying to persuade people of their point of view rather than simply speak to the converted. And evidently, he'd worked so hard on these speeches, he had an argument, and he believed it so thoroughly. I remember old Lyndon Johnson once said, what convinces is conviction. And I think that was true in spades for Abraham Lincoln.
Of course, interpreted depending on the politics of the publication, you quote the New York Herald, 1860, fourth-rate lecturer who cannot speak good grammar. The New York Tribune, if I've got this right, no man ever made such a first impression to a New York audience.
No, it's great. When you read the partisan papers, I mean, there was no attempt at objectivity. I mean, the New York Times comes along a little bit during this period, but most of them, like he would give a speech and they'd say, the audience loved it. They took him out in their arms. And the other paper would say, the audience hated it. They were silent. They were yelling at him the whole time.
And yet, the speeches, the great kind of dialectic of that time, people followed these speeches very closely, and Lincoln would tweak them as he went from place to place and through that make his argument for the nation.
Indeed, politics then was a passion, not unlike sports for us today. I mean, 10,000 people would come and listen to somebody speak for 4 hours. Hard to imagine today.
It is amazing. My guest is Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her big new book is Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of No Ordinary Time, about Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, and, of course, big books on LBJ and JFK as well, now out with her new book, and it's a terrific one, Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. You can join us. What do you think Lincoln would make of the State of the Union today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Of course, Leo Tolstoy, 1909, you quote him, Doris, no scrimping on laudatory stuff here. He says, the greatness of Napoleon, Caesar, or Washington is only moonlight by the son of Lincoln. He was bigger than his country, bigger than all the presidents together, and as a great character, he will live as long as the world lives. Pauline's calling from Williamsville, New York. Hi, Pauline, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is in regard to Lincoln and religion. I've read recently that he spoofed the Bible thumpers that were found on the frontier at that time, and he kind of demeaned fundamentalist religion. I also have heard that when he ran for Congress, one of his opponents spread the rumor that he was a infidel. Given the current political climate today, with religious fundamentalists at the core of much of our debate, I'm wondering what Ms. Goodwin learned about Lincoln and religion.
It's a great question, Pauline. Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Well, it is said that when he was a younger man, he was somewhat of a skeptic. Later in life, I think, he came to a much deeper and more profound understanding of God. I mean, how could one not go through the Civil War and endure those losses without believing that God had some purpose in creating this war, which he seemed to finally come to an understanding that if God had somehow had some hand in this, it was to undo the sin of slavery for both the North and the South. And you watch his writings during the Civil War refer more to God and have a deeper underpinning. But your question suggests something very interesting, which is, as a young politician in today's climate, if he were in one of those parts of America, would he have been able to, expressing those skeptical views, have made his way from step to step to step? It's interesting. One of his friends said, it's true that if you judged him as a non-church-going man, he didn't go to services, he didn't follow the rituals of religion, then you might say that he was not a religious man. But if you judged him by the decency and the morality of his behavior and the fact that he wanted to leave behind the world in a better place, that all the things that might be values that religious people would have were so embedded in him that then he would be considered a very religious man.
It was painfully plain, though, in his early years, as you say, that he didn't believe in an afterlife, and which was doubly hurtful because he took so many losses. So many people that he loved, you can tick them off for us, died, and he did not have the relief of believing he would be reunited with them in heaven.
Absolutely, and that was so unusual at the time. I mean, what you hear about is when people are dying at that time, they often gather around the bedside of the dying person. Even Bates, for example, his 9-year-old daughter was dying, and she felt not worried about dying at 9 years old because she knew she would find her siblings in heaven. The only thing she felt sad about was that she'd be leaving her mother behind. Whereas when Lincoln lost his mother when he was 10, he lost both his siblings, loss after loss after loss, and he lost his first love, Anne Rutledge. Somebody asked him, well, don't you believe that you'll see her in an afterlife? And he said, I wish I did, but I'm not sure that I do. As a result, he was haunted by the idea that we simply become dust in a grave. And I think that's really what prompted him to adopt what we might think of as the Greek notion that you really can live on if you accomplish something worthy, so your deeds are told after you die. And that propelled him through his life.
And was that his notion of the divine at life's end? As the Civil War challenged him, maybe deepened him, forced him to wrestle with the notion of God and the divine, It was more than reputation, surely, that he was thinking about.
Oh, no, definitely. I think I would say by 1862, 1863, he thought much more deeply about God. He understood the force that God must have in life. And that's what's so beautiful in that second inaugural, when he's able to say, you know, maybe the sin of slavery was shared by both the North and the South, both read the same Bible, both pray to the same God, both invoke his aid against the other, but God has his own purposes, and man is never sure what those purposes are. So there was definitely a profound awareness of this force that was God as he got older.
And that empathy projected right across the Mason-Dixon line. Jim is calling from Marlboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Okay. I used to be an employee of the Illinois Department of Historic Sites many years ago and in charge of some of the Lincoln sites.
Plenty of those.
And two quick questions. One of the people that I think was a great influence on Lincoln's life that I don't think has gotten a lot of attention is David Davis, and I would like your thoughts on him. And the second one is that we figured that the Anne Rutledge story may well have been a myth due to the fact that the first place it shows up that we ever found was in Billy Herndon's Life of Lincoln, and some people seem to think that that was Herndon's last shot at Mary, since they didn't like each other very much.
Oh, Jim, you raise a lot of good things. Let us pick them up. Maybe Anne Rutledge first.
Absolutely.
And Billy Herndon, of course, was Lincoln's law partner. Anne Rutledge, his as you write, his great love in New Salem, where Abe Lincoln lived with my aunt and uncle,
John
and Polly Cameron, when he first got there from Indiana.
No, I think what happened is it's true that after Lincoln died, Bill Herndon went around and did oral histories with people, and he gave a famous lecture, I think in 1866 or something, in which he talked about Anne Rutledge, and people were beginning to wonder whether it was, just as the caller said, because he didn't like Mary, Mary didn't like him.
So put a great love earlier and
exactly, and make it seem like he never was able to love Mary. But recent history now, recent historians, there's a wonderful historian named Doug Wilson who's put together all those original oral histories. There are just so many people that recollected his relationship with Anne Rutledge, had details about it, so that it seems impossible that they were all making it up in the same way. So she's now come back in fashion in a way. For a while, Anne Rutledge was out of fashion,
right,
was mythical, but now has come back. And my own instinct is that something was there. We'll never know the full shape of the relationship. There were no letters between the two. There is, at the Library of Congress, I was there last week, there is an English grammar book that was Lincoln's that came from the Rutledge Library. So clearly he knew the Rutledges. So I think that's one of those things that goes through ebbs and flows.
You write from the history that's been collected of him going off into the woods after her death and almost not coming back. One of these moments where Lincoln nearly lost his mind
to despair.
One of
the two depressions in his life, that being the first one. The second one after he broke his engagement with Mary Todd Lincoln and his best friend Joshua Speed was leaving town and his political career was going down. His friends did worry then that he was suicidal, taking knives and razors from his room. But even then, when his best friend Speed said to him, Lincoln, you must rally or you will die, he said, I would just as soon die, but haven't yet done anything to be remembered by. So that theme goes all through his life. But as far as David Davis goes, Charles, I agree with the caller. He's a very instrumental figure.
No rival this. This is among the greatest of allies.
Exactly so. I mean, he was the judge.
Right.
He was the judge on the circuit when Lincoln traveled around. And the funny thing is that in those days, when they're in those boarding houses, the lawyers would have to sleep in the same bed with each other because there weren't enough room in the boarding houses. Judge was the only one who got his own bed because he weighed over 300 pounds. So there was no room for anyone else. But he then becomes Lincoln's unofficial campaign manager and really puts together the strategy and the actual tactics that are used at the Chicago Convention, and then eventually is made a member of the Supreme Court. But he's a great character. His letters to his wife tell of his affection for Lincoln when they're on the circuit, and I think he is an important figure, as your caller suggests.
Lincoln coming out of that convention in Chicago in the wigwam, victorious in 1860 with the Republican nomination against all expectations of his rivals, and yet you write these very strong men that he brought around him. He managed to bring in with empathy. Now, I want to talk about how he developed that, how he deployed empathy, but I wish you'd share first the story of one who wasn't a nominee that year, Edward Stanton, a great attorney of the time, and this amazing story of Lincoln when he's supposed to represent, was it McCormick Farm Implements?
Exactly so.
Tell that, it lays out, if you're an attorney or anything else out there, think about what this took.
So what happens is at that time in 1855, Stanton is a nationally known, celebrated lawyer, and there's a patent case that he's involved in, and they think it's going to be tried in Illinois, so they think they need an of counsel in Illinois. Mm-hmm. Somebody comes and interviews Lincoln and puts him on the case. And
this is from McCormick Farm Implements, huge farm,
exactly.
Kind of the Microsoft of its day, churning out discs and harrows and plows.
And Stanton knows that his reputation will depend on his winning this case. Mm-hmm. And then the case gets transferred from Illinois to Ohio, where Stanton comes from, so they don't need Lincoln anymore, but they never tell him.
And Lincoln is fully prepared for this vast case.
He works all summer on the briefs. He's so excited. He'll be a nationally known person. He gets to Cincinnati, where the case was being tried. Stanton takes one look at him. Stanton was pretty hot-headed and passionate. And Lincoln looks a little disheveled, and he looks backwoodsman, and his trousers are too high. And he whispers to his partner, "We must get rid of this damn long-armed ape. He will hurt our case." They walk away from him. Lincoln had said, "Let's go up to the courthouse in a gang." He was very outgoing. Yeah. They turn him. They don't eat with him at the boarding house.
They never
open his brief. It is, for Lincoln, one of the most difficult times of his professional life, because he had been doing well in Illinois up to that point. And yet, 6 years later, when his first Secretary of War, Cameron, fails, and everybody comes to him and said, "Stanton's your man. You need him. Hot-headed, yes. Blunt, yes. Tough, yes. He'll be the great, great guy for your job." He's able to forget that past hurt and make him his Secretary of War, and then ending up that Stanton loves him more than anyone outside of his family. That's an incredible transformation.
That depth of insult, after all that investment of labor and hope, to be treated so poorly, and then where did that empathy come from? How was he able to understand even Stanton, and was it forgiveness or was it more Machiavellian? Was it, it will work for me and the country, even though I don't really forgive him? You must have got right into the nub of that with this book.
Well, you know, I think it's probably both. I mean, I think at a certain level you have to forget the hurt or else it's going to poison your relationship. And what he said was that he didn't have time for personal contention. He didn't want to waste precious energies on the past. So he comes to Stanton, and he realizes that Stanton is going to be good for him and the country. And if he's good for the country and for him, it's going to help both people. So in a way, it is prudential. It is political. But it's a good kind of politics.
Now, today we see politics can be so polemical, so polarized famously now. They seem the opposite of empathetic politics. Was it the same then? Was Lincoln an oddball when he came with this? You know, it's a kind of a left-handed way of doing politics. It turned out to be genius, but was it received as strange, bizarre even?
I think it was bizarre even then, because you had parties that people had been loyal to their whole life, so that it's part of their identity even more than it might be today. You know, if you were a Whig or you were a Democrat or later becoming a young Republican, that's a big part of how you think of yourself. So the anger between the different sides, and then you think about the anger between the North and the South, where people are actually using revolvers and canes to hit each other on the Senate floor. We may not look nostalgically back at this as an easy time. So Lincoln was unusual that way. But the thing is, it just shows that, you know, in the hands of a great politician, those qualities that we normally associate with decency really do work. I mean, that's the conclusion I just kept coming to time and again. If people understood that today, it's not that they have to become better people. They just have to understand that treating people with kindness, sensitivity, forgetting these grudges, getting over these hurts, not denouncing them, will, in the end, make them a better political force.
It's a list that you lay out: kindness, sensitivity, compassion, honesty, and empathy. It hardly sounds like the rule book for contemporary politics. As Lincoln deployed it, Did he feel like a sap who had no other choice, or did he feel like he was playing for the ages and this would out for him, this would work for him?
Yeah, I know some people have wondered, was it masochistic for him to be able to do this? But I think that he really was playing for the ages. If you have such a huge burning ambition, then you're willing to sort of let these things slide right now if it's going to help you in the long run. Even Chase, for example, I mean, during his presidency, Chase was constantly talking to people against him, using his Treasury patronage to build up his own political machine, tried to run against him in 1864. Lincoln, of course, wins that second election. And then an opening occurs on the Supreme Court chief justiceship. And all of his friends come to him, and somebody wants Stanton to be it, or Blair, his postmaster general, or Bates. And he says, no, I'm going to appoint Chase. And they're stunned. How can you do that? He said such terrible things against you. And he said, I know meaner things he said about me than any of you. He followed everything. Mm-hmm. He talked to reporters.
He wasn't blithe ignorant at all.
Oh, my God. He knew everything. And he said, I'd actually rather swallow a chair than appoint him to this post. But he will be the best man for the emancipated slaves. Chase was an abolitionist, an honored past in dealing with black Americans. And he was right. And then that helps Lincoln to keep his legacy going because of Chase's chief justiceship. It makes sense. It just doesn't make short-term sense.
Right. Kind of amazing double backflip. Rob's calling from Needham, Massachusetts. Rob, you're on the air.
Hello, and thank you for having me on. This is a wonderful show, and it's wonderful to hear Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I wanted to have your reaction to a story I read not too long ago that I had never heard of before. I was reading a book on the history of the Northern Midwest Territories, and during the Civil War, there was a very severe Indian uprising. And after it was put down, many of the captured Indians were under sentence of death. And it went to Lincoln to review. And it just struck me, it's the middle of the Civil War. Indians are barely considered human beings. He could have simply ignored it or okayed whatever the lower officials wanted to do. But he reviewed every case of every Indian under sentence of death.
This is the Black Hawk War?
No, this is later.
Later.
This is later, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He only approved of the death sentence when there was hard evidence that the person involved was a killer, and he commuted the rest.
It's amazing.
I was just struck by his, he was able to make these tough decisions, but he reviewed every single case.
Robert, time is short. Doris Kearns Goodwin?
No, you're absolutely right. And not only did he do it in that case with the Indians, but nothing gave him more pleasure than pardoning soldiers who had fallen asleep on their duty or somehow had been afraid in battle. At least he felt he could save a life by doing that while everybody else's lives were being lost.
We've just got a couple of minutes left. One point you make, that Abraham Lincoln saw it as his mission ultimately to save and improve. Interesting word, to save and improve the democracy established by Washington, Jefferson, and Adams. These days, we often put our political life in terms of preserve rather than improve. Where did he get the chutzpah to see himself as improving on the founding fathers?
Well, I think he understood, obviously, that if America was going to be a beacon of hope to countries all around the world, and he believed that's what he was really doing. It wasn't just saving the Union, getting a bunch of southern states to not secede. If they seceded, he felt, the whole idea that ordinary people could govern themselves would be undone. And then countries abroad who had monarchies or dictatorships would look with pleasure on the loss of that American experiment. And in order to improve it, you had to do something about slavery, which was the cancer, as he once said, that was put on our system in the Constitution. So if he could not only save the Union, keep the democratic experiment going, but undo slavery, the one thing left from the founding fathers that was threatening and had threatened and tore us apart, then indeed it was chutzpah, but what a great sense of chutzpah.
We've only got half a minute. By the time of his assassination, did he feel that he had accomplished what he set out for in terms of his own mark in the world and that save and improving of democracy?
He did know, and that gave me a lot of solace. You know, I hated to bring his story to an end after living with him for 10 years. He was so companionable, but at least there was solace in knowing that surely he knew, with the Emancipation Proclamation, he had done something that would last forever, and that there was a sense, especially once he got the constitutional amendment on top of that, but even more importantly, that this country probably would be preserved.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, author of Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. It's a wonderful read and wonderful chapter of American history. Thank you so much for being
with us. Oh, you're so welcome. I enjoyed it very much.
You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Mary Moore, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.